The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Today's pod evolved from all those times we've given Philippe Auclair 2 minutes to rant about football's governing bodies, state-funded ownership, corruption and money swirling around all the wrong places in the game. We wanted to give him the time and space to talk about them. Our lawyers didn't. Today we'll discuss Newcastle United's proposed takeover and ask about club ownership in general. Who should really be allowed to own a football club? And is there a football team in the UK who you can support with a completely clear conscience? Also, agents. Keir Jarabson's influence at Arsenal's been in the press recently, but how much power does he have? And how do super agents become super agents? And the Women's World Cup in 2023 will take place in Australia and New Zealand. How did they win the vote? And is World Cup bidding now fair? We'll do all that, discuss more if we can, and then it'll all be edited out because someone in a suit got a little bit scared. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. So, on the panel today, Philippe Auclair, how are you?
I'm looking forward to this one, Max.
This is the moment you've been waiting for.
All these years.
Tarek Panja from the New York Times here as well. Hey, Tarek.
Hi, guys. Excited to be here with you and especially with Philippe.
Yeah, of course. Are you?
Let rip, Philippe.
Are you here to provide the sort of editorial balance? Will you get us out of the tricky holes that Philippe may put us in?
Let's see. It's going to be interesting. I'm glad you've got the lawyer on standby.
Hey, Barry.
Hello.
I'm hoping, a bit like Jimmy McGill in Better Call Saul, did you train to become a lawyer overnight, Barry?
I'm not familiar with that reference, but no, I haven't. But I can see in the background of Philippe's Zoom window that a Guardian lawyer has just sidled into his study and is standing there with a shotgun aimed at his head. I'm not sure why I'm here today, Max. I reckon I'll just say allegedly a lot.
Which, as we know, is no defence at all. It is a serious question, I guess, in that we don't talk about these issues that much. If you think about how much airtime is devoted to football and how many pages in newspapers and pages on websites, there's so much, you know, in the history of corruption, backhanders, then racism, sexism, abuse, nepotism, etc. Why, Philippe, do you think there isn't that much?
Well, the first thing to say is that there is more here, perhaps, than there is anywhere else. And that there is at least a culture of investigation in the British media, which is almost completely absent from other journalistic cultures. Investigative journalism, for example, and football politics journalism in France is close to non-existent. There's just a few people there. In Italy and Spain, there is none. In Germany, there is some, obviously. We know that there are some wonderful writers like Thomas Kirstner, for example. There is a tradition as well in Scandinavia. But by and large, it is here in the UK that we ask those difficult questions. And I guess that you don't want to spoil the party, Max. You know, it's one thing, you're invited, and then you start complaining about every single thing once you're in the room. Nothing is quite right. Everything is awful. And people look at you and say, well, where did you come to start with? So therefore, you tend to be on the quiet side. And also, the big problem is that we love football. If we didn't love football, there wouldn't be a problem at all, Max. This is the paradox.
Do you think, Tarek, that we also want to put our head in the sands a bit, right? A lot of people use football as escapism and don't want to ask yourself difficult questions.
Yeah, I think absolutely there's something in that. Arrigo Sacchi said it's the most important of the least important things. So, you know, you've had a tough day or whatever and you just want to watch the match. You don't want, you know, Philippe or I pouring, you know, cold water over this show that you've just watched, this team that you've been supporting, by mentioning, you know, some of the underhand things that are happening behind the scenes. That said, I think when it comes to the media, there's a couple of interesting elements to it as well. Overseas, Philippe mentioned kind of a lack of investigative journalism scrutiny. But I think there's an element of culture there in some countries where there is a lot of deference to power. And a lot of these football clubs are kind of powerful institutions run by powerful men. And you know, you don't, in certain parts of the world, you know, you don't really want to rock the boat when it comes to those guys. And here, I think there's an access issue, and I've felt it here as well. There is an issue. Well, look, we're on the right side. We're on the good side of these guys. They're giving us a player interview. That you know, you've got your accreditation or all this other, you know, the other accoutrements that come with being a sort of sports journalist in the UK. And access is a really big thing. And I think that's quite scary in the sense that things aren't being reported because you don't want to upset people. That stuff needs to be said. And I had an issue recently where quite a senior journalist, through no prompting of my own, said, well, those stories aren't for our pages, they're for the front of the book. And I don't think that's right. You know, we're not just here to report on the sport. All of this is a part of the sport. It's followed by millions of people. It deserves the scrutiny that it gets. And there's no reason why you shouldn't enjoy someone, you know, scoring a volley like Van Basten in 88 and also not want to read about what happened behind the scenes. It's all part of this game that these people are so invested in. We should be reporting this stuff.
And they're hard to do, right? You know, they take time, they're difficult, you have to get it right, as opposed to just saying, well, I think Luke Shaw's the best left back in the country. Is, you know, you don't need to sort of get that checked by multiple sources.
The one thing is that they also cost a lot of money, because the amount of time that you're going to spend to get the story right, the amount of time you're going to spend to find a source or to do all the research is such that, especially in the current climate, you're very, very lucky if you've got an editor or you work for a magazine which is big enough and solid enough to allow you to carry on with this investigation. And I'll take, you know, a personal example. When we did the whole series of articles about Qatar with France Football for 3 years, the only reason why we were able to do that is because of one editor who decided that he was going to almost like base the editorial policy of the magazine on this particular dossier. And that was an editorial decision, but it cost the magazine a lot of money. And many, many people are not in this situation. And I go back to what Tariq was saying. Because of what we were printing, we did at the time lose a lot of access. We did actually lose a lot of good favors from a number of people who thought, fairly or unfairly, that we had decided to have a go at them. And it's a massive issue. And you can imagine if you're the Guardian Football Weekly and you decide, well, we're going to do this program, there might be consequences. And the consequence might be that your phone doesn't ring any longer. That's all.
So is football a force for good, Tariq?
Well, yeah, because it makes millions of people happy. And I suppose, you know, on that very basic metric, that is a force for good. Whatever you've got in your life, it means a lot to you know, people all around the world. And there is that. And then suppose you've seen recently the kind of power it can have through some of the social movements or Marcus Rashford and his scheme the other day. That wouldn't be what it was if he wasn't a football player playing at Manchester United, perhaps. And then yesterday there was the Crystal Palace Burnley game, and the Palace fans had a section that they're normally in. They devoted to the local food bank, and probably to that food bank. That type of thing means a lot. So it is this enormous platform for good. However, that platform it has for good is also what draws in some of the schemers and some of the nefarious individuals we're talking about. You know, it allows people to use its profile for the wrong reason. It allows people to money launder. It allows people to sort of gain power. So, you know, there's a pros and cons from that platform, but on balance, yeah, it makes millions of people happy. It's a great thing.
Let's talk about the Newcastle United takeover. Premier League owners and directors test are still ongoing. The news of a crackdown on piracy by two separate authorities in Saudi Arabia was seen as significant last week. Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab told Sky it's right that we welcome engagement, investment into football in this country, but legal safeguards must be properly followed. That's the first intake of breath from Philippe there. Saudi Arabia's always denied aiding the Be Out Q operation, which is obviously the channel that is illegally broadcasting Premier League football across that region, and insists there's no link between its government and the alleged piracy. Philippe, what do we think will happen? Is it worth speculating?
I think it is worth speculating, and I think that one of the most interesting aspects of this story is that the deal between Mike Ashley and the prospective buyers, led by PIF chairman, obviously Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. What is very interesting is that this deal was presented as if it had been done and as it had been wrapped. It was only a question of crossing a few, you know, dotting a few I's, crossing a few T's and so forth. And it had been basically done. And I think, I mean, Tariq and I actually have been talking about this particular subject for quite a long time and felt that there was something which was not quite maybe right about what was going on. It was taking far too long. Also, it's very much unlike the Saudis, when you talk to people who have been involved in business with them, to actually go public before the deal is completely done. And actually, many people are like that. You do the deal, then you talk about it. Remember, actually, what Mike Ashley has said during the previous failed takeover, which was, if you start to hear about the deal in the media before it's being concluded, there's a very good chance it will not happen. And what we've seen with Newcastle is a kind of slowed down, it's almost like you've slowed down the film to a standstill. And that has been complicated as well by the fact that one of the main protagonists, Amanda Staveley, is also at the same time involved in this court case in London, which Tariq has been reporting on very regularly for the New York Times. And at the moment, to be absolutely honest, I'm hedging my views. I'm not sure. I thought it was going to go through, that it was just being slow and that was understandable. But at the moment, given the positions of the Premier League between a rock and a hard place, all the stuff, I mean, it's many of the stories that that are circulating at the back, the fact that there is now talk of two other bids which could possibly be put on the table at some point in the future, I have a feeling that we've come to a point where this is now on standby. And to be honest, whether the screen will be switched off or switched on, I don't know for sure at the moment, Max. A very long winded answer, but basically it's a very complicated situation. By the way, can you say, just one last thing. When you talk about Saudi involvement in BRQ, what we should do is just to tell people they can make up their own mind by reading the report which was done by the World Trade Organization, which is available online, and it's all there, black on white, 70 pages. You can read it and you'll make up your own mind.
It's interesting, Philippe, you talk about the more talk there is about a deal before it's completed, the less likely it is to be completed, because I remember when Manchester City were taken over, that was unveiled as a fait accompli. No one knew a thing about it. Do you think, I mean, we're not, Mike Ashley tends not to speak or divulge any information, but should the Premier League not at least keep us updated without necessarily betraying any confidences? Because whatever your thoughts on the rights and wrongs of this potential takeover, it leaves Newcastle in a bad position. They can't plan for the future. They can't plan player investment in players over the summer or what passes for the close season. And it is tough for them and their fans, obviously.
Yeah, from the Premier League's point of view, it's been, like you say, it's been like radio silence from the beginning, yeah. Every day there's some new element to this takeover or whatever this thing is. And they've been at pains to just not say anything at all. You're right, it's extremely frustrating. We also don't know how this opaque owners and directors test actually works in practice. You see the list on the website or wherever in their rule book, but no one's ever explained how it works. But again, this we talked about it earlier, these teams mean a lot to millions of people that they deserve clarity. It's just, it's not a normal company. And there should be a sort of a to and a fro here. The other thing that's really interesting about the Newcastle deal and how it's in this mess is if it was another Saudi person, not PIF, we wouldn't be in this mess. This is what I find very odd about this. If it was, I don't know, a Saudi company or a brother of the Sheikh, like Manchester City, for example, there is a chance that none of this that is happening right now, the issue of piracy which I think is at the forefront of this, not the human rights issue. It's the issue with be in sports and be out cute, which is holding this up. If it was just another Saudi, none of this would be here, which makes me think, why are you doing it this way? What, you know, you're washing your dirty linen in public. It's embarrassing for everyone. You could have just bought it another way. So I'm very confused.
Just a little thing about failing the director's test. And Tariq, I remember doing an interview with Scudamore in his office, you know, at Gloucester Place. And he at one point pointed to a kind of metal chest of drawers or something like that. And he said, laughing, if you knew what there was in there. And he was referring, I think, to people who had tried but failed to pass the director's test. And obviously, you know, there are some pretty interesting characters. If you think that the Gaidamax could get Portsmouth and that there's worse than that, my goodness, there must be some real, real numbers out there.
Can we ask about ownership in general? Who do you think should be able to own a football club? Or if you want to answer it in a different way, who shouldn't be able to own a football club, Philippe?
Well, thank you. I think the one of the obviously you do not want people who would fail the Premier League fit and proper person test. You don't want these people. Personally, don't think that you should have nation states and or instruments which are directly under the control of nation states. And obviously, it's all. I mean, we could carry on the list like that for a long time. I mean, in an ideal situation, obviously, you're looking at a situation where, and we're going to be, I'm going to be, people are going to tell me, you know, you're just a dreamer, but I do think the fans should own the clubs. And at the moment, I'm afraid that the ownership model that we see in Germany is probably the one that is closest to the one I would like to see everywhere else, but it's not going to happen. It's more a question of actually stopping. And I know people are going to be very angry with that because there'll be all these PSG fans, Manchester City fans and so forth who say, oh, how can you say this? How can you say that? It's just a question. It's a rule for everybody. It's not a question of actually excoriating a particular type of regime or it should be none whatsoever because we can see what it leads to. So it's a very difficult question to answer what you just asked, Max. Thank you very much for asking me.
It's all right. We got an interesting question from Will who said, look, given there's a lot of focus on what governing bodies and supporters should do and think about takeovers, is enough focus directed towards players and managers who may work for less reputable owners? It's life-changing money to us, but is it to someone earning that much? I mean, should we view players and managers, sort of like Roy Keane's been linked to managing Azerbaijan. It's slightly different, but still, you know, Azerbaijan has a bad human rights record. You know, but should we look at players who would join PSG or Man City over other football clubs? Should we judge them or question them? Tariq?
Nice one, Max. I think, no. Look, these are individuals who are part of a structure. They didn't. It would take a very strong figure to say, right, that's it, I'm downing tools and I'm gonna kind of either leave the industry or I'm not playing for this club. I've devoted my career training to be a professional footballer. That means that I want to play at the highest level and try and be successful in my little world. It's difficult for the player or the manager or whoever else to say, you know, I'm gonna take a knee here. Obviously, I think that the first person or someone did that would probably get a lot of support, but it'd be a very brave person. We shouldn't expect them to do that. And the same goes for, and I think they've been kind of unfairly treated a bit, Newcastle supporters as well, because it's Newcastle this time, but there's nothing inherent in the Newcastle fan and their excitement at perhaps being bought by whoever that they might return to some form of exciting times at their football club. The issue, and back to what Philippe said, is the fact that anyone can seem to buy these things and use the club for whatever they want, and the supporters are part of it. These supporters didn't choose to be part of some sort of political game involving Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Azerbaijan, whoever else. It's a structural problem that football has that needs to be dealt with from like the top down, rather than ask individuals to sort of step up and make the difference themselves. I think that's asking a little bit too much.
And another thing, Max, it's a bit like if you're a journalist, a writer, and you're employed by ultimately a publisher, which has got a very dodgy record in some areas, politically speaking, for example. But if what you write is actually something that is not tainted by the ownership, it is still valid. You know, it's the argument that George Orwell used. I can't remember if he said the Daily Mail or the Telegraph. We're talking, by the way, a long time ago, dear lawyers. But he said, you know, it's not because it's printed in the Telegraph or the Mail that it's wrong or untrue. And similarly, for us, we can sometimes write or talk for people whom we don't necessarily agree with or who might have something quite reprehensible about what they're doing. But as long as we don't do their own propaganda, the difference is that if a player suddenly accepted to become a propaganda tool himself or herself, that is completely different. And this is the moment at which you would say, come on, guys, this is not quite on. It's one thing not to be involved in denouncing, criticizing the people who are actually paying you. It's quite another to do something on top of what you're supposed to do to advance their cause. And I think this is where you can probably put the limit. And the other thing I would say, Tariq was mentioning Newcastle, there is another thing I would mention, is that we shouldn't think that this is the only evil, inverted comma, in the modern game. There is another one which I'm becoming actually obsessed about, which is gambling and betting, which is transforming football into a massive washing machine for dirty money by people using completely untraceable accounts, particularly in the Far East, Philippines, and China. We're talking about $1 trillion a year, which is going through this washing machine every year, which is the dirtiest money imaginable. It's drugs money, it's extortion money, it's corruption money, whatever you want to call it. And it's something that we hardly talk about. So,
sorry, can you just unpick that a little bit? That is different to licensed bookmakers here, which may also be seen as a problem.
Yeah, well, the licensed bookmaking, to be absolutely honest, I mean, it would be very difficult to have a license if you're a Chinese bookmaker, because there are no licenses in China. What they do is that they generally operate from the Philippines, from Manila, from a particular part of Manila, where there are about, I think, 30% of the office space there is devoted to gambling companies, which have bought licenses from the regulated, so-called regulated Filipino gambling authority. But these betting companies, some of them are actually, you know, they you would know their names. I mean, and but no questions asked. And this is a huge dark side and dark shadow which is projected over the game. And another one which also makes you think, well, when you talk about ownership and when you talk about control, that there is also all this dimension, this element, which we tend to forget completely about.
I suspect the Football Weekly gambling special is probably one for another day, because you could talk about that for hours, the malign influence of gambling, legal and illegal, on football. But to go back to the point about Newcastle, Miguel Delaney, who we all know has been very critical of the potential Saudi takeover of Newcastle, and has got a lot of grief from Newcastle fans on social media, who point to the Saudi involvement in Miguel's paper, The Independent, and accuse him of hypocrisy. But maybe they have a point, but I would argue that surely if Miguel is actually standing up and being vocal in his criticism of his paymasters, that's quite a brave thing to do. I feel a certain sympathy for Newcastle fans because, as Tariq said, they're sort of helpless stooges in this, but they can still, you know, no one's expecting them to walk away from their team. That's entirely a matter of personal choice. But they can still help inform their fellow fans who are, you know, tying themselves in knots to defend the Saudi regime and Saudi human rights abuses and engaging in silly whataboutery sometimes. So, you know, you can still be a force for good and still support Newcastle United without, you know, it doesn't make you a terrible person.
It may be a case of where you draw the line, and I don't know if any of you have the answer to this, but what is the biggest football club in the Premier League or the EFL that you can support with a completely clear conscience?
Well, I mean, Burnley springs to mind, but there may well be skeletons rattling around in a closet at Turf Moor that I'm not aware of. I don't know, but you know, I don't think you can, if a club, I'm not, you were asking earlier, Max, who's the perfect owner, and obviously it's fans, but growing up reading Shoot magazine and becoming interested in football, no one ever discussed who owned clubs. You know, it was invariably local businessmen. Some of them were absolute shysters and others were good, but no one was really interested in who owned the club apart from locals who supported the club. And it's a kind of a quite recent thing where ownership, we all became obsessed with it, and that's because hedge funds started getting involved, American investors. Now we have nation states. You know, it's things have changed. Ideally, you wouldn't have an owner. You have more of a custodian, but that's not the case anymore.
We should go through it. We should go through the tables and just find out everything and see how we get on. Here's a question from Ol. It says, who do the panel consider the worst owners of a football club of all time?
Well, the Oystons at Blackpool were a bit special, weren't they? One of them was a convicted rapist. That's common knowledge. And then they absolutely rinsed the club, acid stripped it to within an inch of its life. And Blackpool fans eventually got so fed up that they stopped going. They mounted and carried out a serious, proper boycott. And it wasn't until the Oystons left that they started going back to games. I remember we had a lady on from their supporters group on the podcast, and she was a dyed-in-the-wool Blackpool fan, but she just stopped going to games. And I think we spoke to her after her first game in a couple of years, and you know, she was just so happy to get rid of the Oystons.
But it was interesting how she spoke about how it did divide. You know, it caused so much friction between families and supporters and all of that. Yeah. And you know, the lengths that they had to go to. Any advances on the Oystons?
I don't know if it's the worst, but this the revolving door at Portsmouth in the 2000s was remarkable. I think it started with the chap in Hong Kong, the moneylender, and then a chap called Ali Al-Faraj, who was from Saudi Arabia. It'd never been seen that he ended up being referred to as Ali Al Mirage. And then we had the Dubai Donald Trump, Suleiman Al-Fahim briefly appeared, and then a chap called Mr. Antonov who collapsed a bank. And I just imagine being a supporter at that point where you just think, all right, we've got a new owner. This is going to be the one. We'll be back. And this, time and time again, it was over a very short period of time where these guys all came flooding in. Remarkable. I don't know if it's a word, but it must have just been awful.
Well, I remember during that time, Jamie Jackson, who's now our Manchester correspondent at The Guardian, he was tasked with covering all that coming and going at Portsmouth. And the guy was traumatised, like, because he had to sort of take a crash course in all this financial stuff he didn't really understand and wasn't particularly interested in. And it just went on and on and on, and every day there'd be another 800 to 1,000 words from Jamie about sort of impenetrable financial stuff. And he I would say he probably considered his position at the time, because that's not what he signed up for when he, you know, dreamt of becoming a football writer.
If I have to write winding up petition one more time.
All he wanted to do was talk about whether Pedro Mendes was the answer in central midfield. Before we end part one, can we talk just briefly about Man City and CAS? Decisions expected in the first half of July. City CEO Ferran Soriano issued an official statement denying the allegations against City, insisting all of the money put into the club has always been properly declared. There are rumours that Pep might return to Barcelona if the ban is upheld. Is it worth speculating what the decision will be? And is it worth asking what the decision should be, Tarek?
I mean, I guess we're going to find out what the ruling will be. What's interesting with CAS is often they side with the governing bodies because it's their rule books. And I guess some people who want a reform of CAS say, well, it's biased because it's actually funded by these groups. So there's that. But the history of the jurisprudence history of this is often the governing bodies win. So if Man City win, it could be seen as an upset, and also how powerful Manchester City have been in opposing this, how much money they've spent on lawyers and everything else. And I'll be interested to see if the written reasons are published whenever the ruling comes. And if it's not, that will also be a cause for concern either way. It's up to all the parties involved if this stuff is ever published, because I would love to see how hard UEFA fought on behalf of this independent panel should it have lost. Because in the case with Paris Saint-Germain, there was a lot of disquiet among the investigators and among the CFCB, this financial control body, that UEFA really didn't defend them enough and essentially gave an open goal to PSG to get through what would have been a pretty painful financial fair play situation. So I'm really intrigued to see how this goes, and I'd love to see the written reasons, whichever way it ends up.
Tariq, if City lose the appeal, is there any higher court or they can go to, or is there any way they can sort of clog the system by throwing money and lawyers at it to sort of delay their punishment?
Well, there is another layer, which is an appeal to the Swiss Federal Court. Now, but that's really limited. You can't relitigate the entire FFP, football leaks, all of that stuff. It will be about very, very limited to whether CAS followed the procedure. So that's the next port of call, and probably the last port of call. But again, you know, if those leaks are to be believed, they are willing to spend another 50 million on lawyers to sue UEFA for forever and ever based on what was published. So I can't believe they'll be willing to give up without a fight. And apart from obviously the financial loss, it's really humiliating, isn't it? I mean, essentially it's saying, ha, we caught you cheating. No one wants to be tarnished with that. And they're gonna try and, you know, fight all the way, as they've said.
Tariq, just one thing. I was wondering, if they were to resort to the federal court in Switzerland, which is theoretically possible, would that have a suspensive effect? Because that might be one of the only reasons, if not the only reason, why you would go there and you say, okay, it has a suspensive effect, therefore we will be able to take part in the 2020-2021 Champions League.
Yeah, we've seen that. There was a really interesting case with the Peruvian centre-forward, Paulo Guerrero, before the Russia World Cup. He failed a drugs test, and Peru hadn't qualified for the World Cup for like a generation. 3 decades, and he was the talisman. And weirdly, kind of everything coalesced. Everyone wanted Peru to be there. All these fans were there. They appealed at the federal court, and FIFA didn't really put up a fight against them taking it to the federal court. And it had a suspensive effect in that Paulo Guerrero played at the World Cup. Peru had their full team, and straight after that, this federal court ruled, no, you haven't got a case. The ban holds, and he got a year and a half's ban from football, but did appear at the World Cup. But in this case, I don't see the point for City in having a suspensive effect, in the sense if they're going to be banned anyway. And also, we're at in this coronavirus time. You know, next season's Champions League, is that going to be particularly exciting with no fans and everything else? Might be one, if you're going to miss one, it might not be the worst one to miss, I guess.
Which is good news for Spurs fans as well, but for very different reasons. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll discuss the role of agents in football. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk about agents. Keir Jarabson's role at Arsenal has come up, Tariq. I know you've done a lot of work on agents. Not necessarily the first agent to have a link with a football club. Is that fine? Is that okay?
It's part of this structure that, you know, we talked about at the beginning of the show. What is football? How does it work? And the kind of model we have now, it's created a place for this group of, say, half a dozen very powerful men to control a really important aspect from a financial and from a sporting perspective of the industry. In the sense that there's a lot of secrecy within the game of clubs not wanting other clubs to know what they're doing, etc. So information is kind of key, and information and is kind of power. And the people that have somehow found their way to know more of what's happening in the industry than anyone else are these group of people, because they are inside the boardrooms of all the clubs. They're able to walk in between and get this information. They also offer clubs who are trying to, you know, tap up or whatever, a degree of deniability as well in the business. So Keir could, you talked about Keir at Arsenal, he could walk into the Arsenal boardroom as he could walk into the Chelsea boardroom, and that gives you enormous amount of power over the structure of the game. Is it right? Is it normal? I guess it is what it is. It shouldn't be, I guess, that this random bloke goes on the radio and tells the world, hey, this is what's happening inside Arsenal. And by the way, I'm actually not a club official, a club employee. I'm a third party figure who's going to claim commissions from here, there and everywhere. It's kind of a nebulous part of the industry where money moves around. And it is through these figures who are at the center of a spider's web, as it were. I know FIFA are trying to reform the transfer market and the role of agents, but I think what they're doing is a step in the right direction, but it just doesn't seem right that six to seven people hold so much power and influence in the game.
So specifically on this Arsenal thing, you know, in show business, right, if you're represented by the same people that represent Anton Deck, it may be that, you know, you'll get work because I say, look, can you sort Barry out, because we need to get him a bit of work, and then we'll let you have Anton Deck. Is that how it might work?
There is an element of that, and that's always been there. But again, this relationship model, and also we're told he's not Adu's agent, but a very, 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 very good friend of Adu. And that's the technical director who has an influence on who's recruited. It all kind of seems, I don't know, a little bit informal and a little bit strange that this is how it works. Again, all perfectly legal. So if you're planning for the future, how do you build a business based on one really important relationship? It just doesn't seem very safe in a way. If you're Arsenal or the owner of Arsenal or the owners of Arsenal, and you're planning for the future of your club, it seems hugely risky that you're hinging your recruitment or a lot of your recruitment on this one random relationship. It doesn't seem to me like the best way of running a football club.
But it almost feels like, you know, it's almost like you put your responsibility on a manager, right? And it's if you get a good one, you know, Wolves have a link with Jorge Mendes. That seems like a really great thing for Wolves. Like, all those fans would be happy about that.
It works in different ways, and I was actually going to make the parallel with Wolves. It's because it is actually completely different. What makes me feel a bit uncomfortable, or it makes me feel uncomfortable about the current situation at Arsenal, is that it's precisely the informality of it, and the fact that you seem to have, on one hand, the American owners, Stan Kroenke, and now Josh Kroenke, who supposedly is in charge of the club, who seem to be in a way completely cut off from this particular sphere, which is a very football-y sphere, which they have very little in common, and which they don't seem to have an awful lot of control over. I might be wrong. It's very different from what you see at Wolves, where Wolves is almost like a project which employs Jorge Mendes, whom, by the way, you know, we all have loads of things to say about Jorge Mendes, but I would say one thing, that compared to an awful lot of his colleagues, he's actually bloody good at his job. Really, really, really good at his job. And he's doing at Wolves what he tried at one point to do with AS Monaco, where he also had a very, very close relationship with the club. And actually, thanks to Jorge Mendes, and you could say it's a horrible thing, but Monaco, you might remember, won the title from PSG. They got promoted. They did very well in the Champions League. Manchester City fans will remember about this one. So I think it's completely different. Mendes, it's very much... it's a business organization. Gestifucci, it's a business organization which has got some elements which are probably not transparent enough, but works in a very different way from this kind of gentleman's agreement, which seems to be the case at Arsenal, which seems to be the case, by the way. I just add one thing to what Tariq was mentioning about FIFA. It's one of the cases where I genuinely think you can say, and Max, you're sitting down, that's good, where actually FIFA is with the good guys. I think the people who are at FIFA TMS, the people who are trying to reform the transfer market, I think they're actually people who genuinely mean business. And I feel very frustrated by the fact that the milieu, that the environment, the clubs and so forth are resisting their efforts. The idea is to go towards complete transparency, which is something which exists, for example, in American sports. And there's no reason why it shouldn't exist for football.
And that would mean if it exists, how does that what does that mean in practice in American sport?
Which means you know exactly how much money is paid and whom it goes to and through which channels and so forth. It also means it can go with things like capping either salaries or the commissions. It has to do with the number of parties that a particular agent. I mean, Mino Raiola has represented three different parties in some transactions: the selling club, the buying club, and the player. I mean, that cannot be right. I'm sorry.
How has that happened? So that Raiola, you know, the Pogba transfer made people just
because you get the mandate.
Just normal football fans be completely staggered by it. So how has it evolved to be that way? It's just not, it's been unregulated for so long, or?
Well, it's different. Some countries don't allow it. England's perhaps the most laissez-faire of them all. Here we have this triple representation situation. But by creating that situation, you create the opportunity for abuse. You know, until FIFA have now brought these rules in, which stops it. And put caps on, I think from just now, yeah, very recently, these caps and commissions, a max of 6%, and 3% if you're acting for the buying club. But it was just kind of allowed. And this is the kind of problem with, well, I guess the game in general. We were talking about ownership before. There were regulations, you know, it's not that long ago. And for example, until like the mid 80s, early 90s, a director couldn't be paid from a Premier League club or a Football League club. You know, you couldn't have a dividend. I mean, so these rules that we're talking about did exist. As I guess the economy moved to kind of the neoliberal one that we have now, football also went down that pathway and created the free-for-all that we're in now. And now, I guess, it might not be the FA, but FIFA is trying to do something about this.
So it's moving in the right direction then, if FIFA are actually doing something good about this.
Absolutely.
Oh, the expression in your eyes, Max, is beautiful.
I want over the next, you know, few months to come back to all these subjects. Let's leave agents for now. You may have noticed Barry being very quiet in part two. That might not surprise anybody, but to be fair to Barry, his Wi-Fi has gone down. So he's just WhatsApped me to say this is deliberate sabotage to get me off the Tuesday pod. So with all, we have to be, if we're talking about fairness in the game, fairness in the pod, Barry may have said some very lucid, important things about agents, but his Wi-Fi is down. We'll be back in part three. Susie Rack will join us. We'll talk about the Women's World Cup bid and World Cup bids in general. Barry may return. He may not. We'll all find out together. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Very pleased to say Susie Rack joins us. Hey, Susie.
Hiya.
Very disappointed to say Barry Glendenning's Wi-Fi has returned. Hey, Barry.
Yeah, hello. Sorry about that.
You missed an excellent part two.
I look forward to listening to it later.
Let's talk about the Women's World Cup then. The FIFA Women's World Cup in 2023 will be hosted by Australia and New Zealand. Their joint offer got 22 of the 35 votes cast by FIFA Council individuals in the first round of voting. The FA's decision to align with UEFA in voting instead for Colombia was called disrespectful by the Football Federation of Australia. Susie, this is the first time the vote has been open. That is a good thing, surely.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And I think it is a much more transparent process than it has been in the past. Although it still differs from the men's in that every federation votes for the Men's World Cup, whereas it's just the FIFA Council that votes for the women. So it's a little bit skewed in that you've only got 35 people voting instead of, you know, over 200 confederations voting. But it was a much more open process. The bids documents were released in public. The research that FIFA had done into each bid, the technical reports, all open and available to read online. And I mean, whilst it's, you know, never going to be completely perfect when it's FIFA. It's a significant improvement on what it has been in the past. So for it to even be as close as it was quite surprising. It shows that there's still a lot of manoeuvring in the background, and you know, every single confederation voted entirely with each other. Block voting is still very much a thing, and I don't think we're going to see it go for a while.
Yes, apparently the FA's Greg Clark refused to take a call from the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, which, I mean, considering that she's the greatest living human, seems like a mistake anyway, regardless of whatever she wanted to call you about. That just seemed like a strange thing to do. It just seems strange that you can't even take a call, even if you're not going to vote for someone.
So bizarre.
Just from a politeness point of view.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
From a courtesy point of view, from a political point of view, from every point of view, actually. Susie?
No, like utterly, utterly weird. I understand that he was busy and couldn't take the call, but, you know, you would shift things around, wouldn't you, if the president of a country that is doing what they're doing at the moment and is as amazingly brilliant as she seems to be, asks to call you up about something that you're going to be voting on in a few days' time. It's just utterly surreal. But, I mean, there's a few reasons why I think Greg Clark did what he did and voted for Colombia. Purely speculation, of course. He's up for re-election as FIFA vice president next year. Obviously, England's going to be going most likely for the 2030 World Cup. They need allies. So voting against the rest of the UEFA bloc would annoy a lot of people in UEFA, no doubt, and would annoy the CONMEBOL vote as well. It's a bit swings and roundabouts is the reason he's done what he's done. I mean, I suppose there is a positive in that women's football is being used as a make weight and is seen to have enough value that it can be used as a make weight in decisions around men's football. In a weird, twisted way, that's kind of a positive. But at the same time, I found it very, very difficult because as I was covering this vote, getting closer and closer, I was also working on a piece on sexual harassment of the physiotherapist of the under 17 women's team by the head coach in Colombia. That and the players at the moment having had all of their contracts cancelled and having to be given food packages and care packages by both the government and the players' union in the country. Meanwhile, the Federation has done nothing. So I found it very, very difficult to in any way support the Colombian Federation's bid, while the players probably deserve it, over what Australia and New Zealand have put together.
What's interesting as well in the case of Didier Luna, I think that's the name of the coach, the Colombian coach, is the fact that normally when you're under investigation of anything, you are suspended automatically by FIFA, by the ethics committee. Now, very interestingly, there was nothing of that kind, and there was no sanction taken by the ethics committee in the case of Didier Luna, regardless of what's happening in civil courts in Colombia, which is quite a different thing. And also, you've got to remember that Colombia was a very important ally of President Infantino when in 2016 at the election. And in particular, the gentleman who is still in charge of the Colombian FA, Ramon Resurún. And in fact, Resurún was one of the people who managed to get one of his own as the head of the ethics committee, who is a Colombian, Maria Rojas. And the fact that Gianni Infantino actually voted for Australia and New Zealand shouldn't make us forget of exactly what is also happening at the back in this particular story.
But Infantino was unhappy with UEFA, right? UEFA said their block vote was Colombia was an attempt to try and increase the growth of the women's game in South America. Reports suggested UEFA delegates urged constituents to ignore FIFA's technical evaluation of the bids, which said Australia and New Zealand was much better than Colombia's, claiming the Women's World Cup was a development tournament. And Infantino slammed those sentiments, saying the Women's World Cup needs to be held in the same regard as the men's tournament. Tarek, on paper, that seems like the right thing to say.
Yeah, and you know, for FIFA, this is going to be the biggest Women's World Cup ever as well. It's been expanded to 32 teams. They're going to pump $1 billion into women's football over the next 4 years. So it's a really significant thing. And the technical report obviously said what it said. There's a couple of really interesting things as well about the way the votes went and this whole process. In February, CONMEBOL en masse arrived at UEFA to sign this very strange memorandum of understanding, sort of a cooperation agreement of some kind, i.e., we're together in everything we do. And I'm not sure what that actually means beyond UEFA and CONMEBOL v. FIFA, Gianni, and everyone else. It's become kind of petty as well, I think, really petty in the sense these are the people that run global football. And there's personality clashes as well, which seem to be dominating these big issues. And that really shouldn't be the way these big structures work. And there's something really strange that CONMEBOL did as well. So this famous technical report that Susie referenced has Australia kind of obliterating Colombia's offer on a number of levels. CONMEBOL were furious, so furious that they wrote this letter and they signed it, "Dear gentlemen of the FIFA Council." And bear in mind, we're talking about the Women's World Cup. They've forgotten there are about six women on the FIFA Council. And they signed off. Senors as well. So, I mean, you know, you can't make some of this stuff up. You know, I think Australia, it seems like they had a better bid. There's many reasons it should be in that part of the world. And you know, good luck to them. I kind of disagree a little bit with Susie that it's a good thing that they used this Women's World Cup as an issue for broader battles. I think it's pretty totally disrespectful to women's football.
Not a good
that
thing.
It's being used as a kind of a sideshow for these other arguments among largely men over nothing to do with women's football. I think it's totally outrageous, but that is where we are, and that's the structure that we're in.
It is what it is, Tariq.
It is what it is.
Australia has always struck me as a place, and New Zealand, that would be brilliant to have a World Cup in, the potential time differences aside, but is the geography of the place, is that a factor that seems to mitigate against them?
There was a suggestion that the European market, where women's football is popular and the TV viewers, based on the last World Cup and previous World Cups, quite high, that there is going to be an impact on that. But again, you just raised the point, Australia and New Zealand will be a place where it'll be quite good to have sporting events. We've seen that in the past, where you're likely to have full stadiums, you're going to have media interest, whereas it'll be more uncertain in Colombia. And look, and if we're never going to have these events in places that aren't suitable for European time zones, then let's just stop bidding for them and let's just put everything in Europe.
Yeah, just one thing, that we shouldn't forget that the technical report, the politics and so forth explain a lot, but the sheer commercial aspect of it is perhaps the most important. It's been a subject of some unease, the fact that, for example, Qatar, when it got the 2022 World Cup, or the USA, Canada, Mexico, when they got 2026, were actually promising to put a lot of money towards FIFA for so-called operational costs and, you know, broadcasting costs and things like that. And Australia have done exactly the same thing. It's not in their bid report, but it is in the technical report that they have proposed to give $77 million, the equivalent of, to FIFA as a contribution, which is not in the Colombia in the Colombia bid at all. So it's an indictment. Okay, we're not going to call that a bribe, but it's certainly an encouragement, a financial encouragement, which FIFA was not deaf to.
Yeah, I was just going to come back on the Infantino attacking the development tournament comments of what was said in the UEFA meeting pre the vote. Because what's interesting about that is, and people have said that a tournament in Australia and New Zealand will be brilliant for many reasons. But the idea that it would be a development tournament in Colombia and not in Australia and New Zealand is also a little bit ridiculous, because in Australia and New Zealand, women's football has sort of, particularly in Australia recently, has sort of kind of hit a little bit of a plateau. It's stagnated a little bit. You've got their biggest stars going to the US, coming to England, going and playing in Europe. Their league has kind of faltered a little bit. It's not necessarily getting the support that there has historically. The women's national team have kind of stumbled a little bit, and pre the last World Cup, their manager was ditched in favour of someone else because of alleged bullying and unhealthy culture in the camp. So Australian football needs this too. I think it will have a huge effect on Australian football, as much, if not more, than it would have in Colombia, because you've got an actual commitment from the federation to really, really go big on it. Whereas Colombia kind of showed no indication in recent months that they give any kind of damn about women's football. So that argument from UEFA was complete and utter rubbish, which was annoying.
Just before we go, and this is not a quick question, I guess, but looking at this bidding process, should we have some hope or faith that the bidding process for tournaments in the future will become more open and clearer, and that we won't have what we've seen with what happened with the Germany World Cup in 06, Russia 2018, Qatar 2022? Do you have faith, Philippe?
No, none.
It's the shortest answer you've ever given.
Because it is a political game, and it's going to become even more of a political game when you see in particular who is going to try to get the 2030 Men's World Cup. This is going to be an interesting one, because if it's not a political decision in 2030 and beyond, well, my goodness. You will have cosmetic improvements, such as you know who will vote for whom. But to be fair, that's cosmetic, because we already knew who was voting for whom. It was just not published on a tweet by FIFA.com. The way it is, I'm afraid that the structure is such that I can't see how it's going to be anything else but what it's been in the past.
Tarek?
It's actually changed for the Men's World Cup. As Susie said, the entire FIFA Congress has 211 votes, which makes it harder to, the right word would be to induce someone to vote for reasons outside of footballing reasons is a lot more difficult. However, there's something funny that happened in the last one, the US and Canada one. CONMEBOL was supposed to vote on block for, I think it was a US and Canada one. The Brazilian guy, it was Colonel Nunes at the time. He'd misheard the request, and he picked the wrong bid. And the problem is they're all published now. So then everyone was like, Colonel, what have you done? And he was like, no, I thought you said this one. So we've got transparency at least.
Look, that'll do for today's podcast. Loads of stuff that we've got through, and certainly potential to talk about each of those for hours and hours on end, which hopefully we'll do over the next few months. Susie, thanks for popping in.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Tarek, thank you.
Hopefully I haven't put the readers off or the listeners off football for life.
Philippe, always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you very much, Max.
Barry, part two, this pod was the best part you've ever done.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We'll be back on Thursday. Me, Barry, David Heitner, Johnny Liu, looking back at the midweek Premier League action.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.